Clerk Dyson, I've heard those words more times than I can count, and so have you. And yet every time I hear them, they do something to me. What say you, sir?
Tavis, I can barely speak, my man. I was just at the Civil Rights Museum, the National Civil Rights Museum, last week, as you know, the memorialization of the spot, room 306, where a report rang out across the parking lot to find its deadly, effective subject in the neck of the greatest leader this nation has ever produced, severing his tie, ripping his face apart, falling back onto the pavement with his knees and his up in the air, his legs bicycling as if he were on a bike. His friend, Ralph Abernathy, going into the room, retrieving a towel and then a jar, and then scooping with that cardboard from a laundered shirt, scooping the blood of Martin Luther King Jr. into the jar, saying, "This is the blood of the prophet sacrificed for us. This is the greatest American we have ever seen." And on this day, 56 years ago, at 6:01 p.m. local time, he gave up the ghost for the love of his people.
I do this every year, in part because I agree with Dr. Dyson that Dr. King is the greatest American this country's ever produced, and so this day is never lost on me. And wherever I am in the world, I spend time in reflection. I spend time in thanksgiving for the life and legacy of one Martin Luther King Jr. And it just turns out for all the years I have had a media platform, every year, if I don't talk to anybody else, I talk to Michael Eric Dyson on this day, and I'm always honored when he receives my phone call and agrees to be a guest on this program. You know my rule. The shorter the introduction, the more important you are. Ladies and gentlemen, the Pope. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, the M to the E to the D. I now give him a proper introduction. Michael Eric Dyson, the professor from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. It's been too long, Michael. How are you, sir?
Man, I'm doing great, Tavis. And not to answer your question, that speech is the first speech of Martin Luther King Jr.'s that I heard. Mm. I was sitting on the living room floor, my father in the big chair right behind me. I was 9 years old, watching the news, when the newsman broke faith with the printed program and announced that Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot. And I turned to my mother and I said, "Well, which one is he?" And then that short, beautiful man whose words were like pathos, brimming with the intensity of our aspiration as peoples, you know, as a people, let loose with that speech you just gave and that you just played. And to me, Tavis, greater than I Have a Dream, greater than How Long, Not Long, that speech was the greatest speech Martin Luther King Jr. ever delivered, because people may not realize he was in his hotel room at the Lorraine Motel, sick, not feeling well. It was raining cats and dogs. He didn't like going into Memphis. He usually liked to get in and get out. What a premonition that was. Mm-hmm. And he was laying up there, and Ralph Abernathy gave him a call and said, "No, Doc, ain't no substitute for you tonight. You got to come here tonight." He gets out of his sick bed, gets dressed, makes it to Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee, to deliver that speech, among which were the choice words, "All we ask, America, be true to what you said on paper." And then he also remembered that a white girl had given him a letter when he got stabbed in his chest. And he said he got a letter from the president he don't remember. Got a letter from the governor he doesn't remember. But he remembers what that white girl said. "I read in the newspaper that if you had sneezed, you would have drowned in your blood. And Dr. King, like any great preacher, took that and made it refrain. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been drowned here in 1964. And then he took off, and then he ended with that great peroration, that ending that you just played, one of the greatest endings to one of the greatest speeches that we have ever heard. So, yes, those words continue to thrill me and lift me up when I hear them.
We'll talk more about that speech and more when we come forward, commemorating in this hour the life of the greatest American this country's ever produced, Martin Luther King Jr. And, of course, because he's Michael Eric Dyson, we will probe him on a number of other issues as we move through this hour. How blessed are we to be in dialogue with the M to the E to the D on Tavis Smiley.
From the Merck Park with love, this is Tavis Smiley. Smart talk for curious people just like you. Just like you. You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
And with the utmost pride and sincerity that I present this recording as a living testament and recollection of history in the making during our generation.
You can't talk to Michael Eric Dyson without playing some Jay-Z. You like that, Dyson? You like that?
A CEOMED. Yes, sir. I love it.
Yeah, if you know Mike Dyson as I do, and I know him rather well, you got to play some Jay-Z at some point during the hour. And you heard it. You heard Jay-Z said he got the hottest chick in the game. We'll talk about that chick a little later in this hour. And her new project, Cowboy Carter. We'll talk about that and let Dyson sound off on that as well. So a lot to talk about.
He might be wearing her tape, Doc.
I take your point. We'll talk about that and unleash Michael Eric Dyson on that subject matter and a few others as we move through this hour. But we're going to continue our conversation for a moment here, giving props to MLK. As we commemorate his assassination, 56 years to go on that balcony at the Lorraine in Memphis. So Michael Eric Dyson, moments ago, told you his story about when he first got exposed to King. He was 9 in Detroit. I was 15 in Indiana. And as it turns out, once I got exposed to him, I was exposed to him at 12, at 12. And by the time I'm 15 and I'm in high school, I'm on the speech team, and I am engaged in a contest called OI, Oratorical Interpretation. As the title suggests, you take somebody else's oratory and you interpret it as you see fit. And I still hold records in the state of Indiana for winning speech contests up and down the state, doing my part to interpret the words of Dr. King. Every speech I could get my hands on, every year, every season I was in high school, all 4 years, you had to have a different speech that you would do for the season. And I did 4 years on the speech team, and I did 4 different King speeches, and I racked up blue ribbons and championships all up and down the state. Letting Kings imbibing what he had to say and trying to share that with audiences up and down the state. And then they start calling me to speak here at this gathering and this convention and this place. So Lil Tavis was known all over Indiana as the guy that was delivering his interpretation of Dr. King's words. And those words, Michael, have a way of getting inside of us the more we recite them, do they not?
That's absolutely true. And I won the oratorical contest for the Optimist Club and certainly was inspired by Dr. King. So both of us owe our careers, and the rhetorical majesty we've been able to access through Dr. King.
Yeah.
Yes, there was something powerful about him, his voice, his intonation, his Southern accent. And then we'll speak about Miss Beyonce later on. But that Southern accent that reverberated around the world, that echoed across the corridors of time, because it was deeply drenched in learning. He was unapologetic about his learning. He was unapologetic about absorbing all that he could learn so that he could turn it into powerful grist for the mill of black freedom. And so something about his voice, the timbre, the tone, the intonation, the way in which he really unleashed that voice in his own pace. Now, he understood his lane. That's why he would never really debate Malcolm X, because in a debate 101, you know, Malcolm would have lapped the going around the lap about 3 or 4 times while Dr. King was just clearing his throat.
Yeah.
Now, Malcolm, he would have said, "You've been bamboozled. You've been cooked. You've been had. I have. You've been had." You know, so it had been rough, Doc. It had been rough.
Yeah.
It had been rough to debate Malcolm X at that level. That's why Bayard Rustin had to debate Malcolm X, because he had a faster clip.
Oh, yeah.
But Dr. King's beautiful voice, it was resonant. It was like a singing voice. And when he, you know, stretched those words out, like Sam Cooke with melisma, down in Alabama with this vicious racist.
Mm.
So there was some euphony to his voice, the melodic intensity of his voice, but also the somberness. The late, great Dr. Gardner Taylor said, there was a tear at the center of his voice.
Mm.
And so there was a tear. There was a sadness.
Yeah.
There was a melancholy that reverberated in his voice, but there was eternal hopefulness in that voice as well.
Yeah, and y'all thought Dyson was just a scholar and an author. No, he does impersonations and anything else that he that he wants to do. I was laughing while you were talking. I was thinking about the story I shared about running around the state of Indiana reciting his words at age 15. I'm in high school reciting his stuff at 15. But as you know, at 15, King was on the way to Morehouse, man. At 15.
Now, Tavis, I was doing my thing as a young man. Well, yeah, because, and I'm glad you mentioned that,
yeah,
because there was an early admission to young students, young black men in particular, because World War II had diminished the ranks, so to speak. And so Martin Luther King Jr. got in on that early admission because of the decimation of our masculine community during the war. That's the same program, by the way, that Maynard Jackson got in later on at
That's
the age
right.
of 15.
That's right.
So they were prodigious, to be sure, but they were enabled by some other factors. But yeah, he was a bad boy. He was called Tweed. He was like you in that sense, though. He was called Tweed because he wore such stylish suits. And when he and his boy were called the Wrecking Crew, and they asked him why they were called the Wrecking Crew, because we wreck all the ladies. So he was, yeah. So Dr. King had another side.
Yeah, yeah. For those who may think it's sacrilegious that Dyson and I are laughing in this conversation about Dr. King, that's because you didn't know Martin King. He was a jokester and a prankster himself, was he not, Dr.
Ooh,
Dyson?
Lord, Doc. I can't even repeat some of them jokes, but there is no doubt. People were talking to him about being afraid to fly. He said, "It's not that I don't trust God in the air. I've just got more experience with him on the ground." So,
no, he was funny, man. And of course, he told the funny story when he went to the Tonight Show when Belafonte was hosting the Tonight Show, and King told a funny story when he arrived. And you know the story, Dyson. You want to tell it? Shall I tell it?
You tell it, Doc. You are the master.
No. You're a better storyteller than I am. The short version is that King was appearing on The Tonight Show when The Tonight Show was in New York, was back in New York these days. Jimmy Fallon took it back years ago after Jay Leno had it for all those years with Johnny Carson here in L.A. King was in Atlanta and had agreed to appear on The Tonight Show. Harry Belafonte, his dear friend, was hosting, sitting in that week. And King had agreed to appear on the show. By the way, there's a documentary, about that week that Belafonte sat in hosting the Tonight Show, because everybody in their mama, it's a great documentary. I mean, everybody you can imagine, because of Harry Belafonte's connections, came through that show that week. And just that one week has been worthy of books and articles and documentaries about the week that HB, Harry Belafonte, sat in on the Tonight Show. But King was scheduled to be a guest that night. He's in Atlanta, was running late, got on a plane at the last minute, landed at the LaGuardia, got into a cab and told the brother, young brother driving, he said, "I'm late for the Tonight Show. I can't do it in the King voice as Dyson would." He said, "But I'm late for the Tonight Show. Get me there as quickly as you can." This Negro starts running red lights, driving up on sidewalks. The car is on two wheels, doing everything he can to get Dr. King to the Tonight Show on time for this live show. And Dr. King said, brother, slow down. I'd rather be Dr. King who arrived late than the late Dr. King." He told that story on the Tonight Show, and it killed. So every now and then, he would allow his humor to come through in public. But Dyson, my read and my understanding and my research suggests to me, and I think you probably agree, that one of the reasons he was afraid to show his humor in public is because he always wanted to be taken seriously. And his work was so serious, he didn't want to give anybody any room to think that he was playing with this working witness.
That's a brilliant interpretation, a brilliant analysis, and it's true. And it also shows the pressure under which Dr. King labored, and it shows the intense respect for his craft, but also the fact that white folk were unfair. You could be a famous white person, have a great sense of humor, and it would be great.
Mm-hmm.
But a Negro, as we were then called, doing the same was unserious, incapable of intellectual acuity and cerebral loftiness, and therefore Dr. King felt that pressure. He felt it as early as graduate school when he talked about not wanting ever to be late for class because he would live up to the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
So Negroes were laughing and shucking and jiving, and he wanted to show by his dress, by his thin necktie, by his fedora that he wore, that I'm all business, the same way Malcolm X did. I'm here for serious business. I ain't shucking and jiving. I ain't smiling in your face and then going behind your back to cuss you out. I'm being who I am, and this is the business of the people. So, yes, yeah. He didn't have the luxury and leisure, but more, my God, among his own friends, that man was, he might as well have been Richard Pryor, Doc.
Yeah.
He was pretty funny.
And as we all know, the night just before he dies, the night before, he and Andy and are pillow fighting.
Oh, man.
Pillow fighting in the hotel.
Pillow fighting, Doc.
Grown men
Go to
pillow
Negro,
fighting.
Negro, where you been? But he didn't say Negro.
He sure
but
did.
Anyway.
He sure did not. He sure did not. Let me circle back. Let me circle back to this speech. We started this hour playing audio of his last great speech, and to Dyson's point, and I think I probably agree, the greatest speech King ever gave. And that's a great, that could be a barroom brawl right there, a barroom brawl about his greatest speech. But Dyson has sounded off on his point of view, and I just shared my point of view as well. Bottom line is, neither of us believes that I Have a Dream is his greatest speech. Everybody else does, but not Dyson and not Smiley. But back to that speech, it took me a while, Mike, to figure this out. But after I studied it over and over and over again, I finally connected with what was really happening that night. When you watch the video, not just the audio, but when you watch the video of King giving this speech at Mason Temple that night, you know this better than most. You probably know where I'm going with this. If you watch him and just watch his eyes, his eye, you know where I'm going, don't you? His eyes are darting all over that room. That threat of death was on him so tough. The death threats were coming in so fast and so furious that in that night, in that speech on that night, King he's doing his thing as brilliantly as ever, as Dyson and I both agree, better than ever. But if you Google it don't do it now while we're on the air, but when you get a chance today, Google that speech. There's video of it. And just watch Dr. King's eyes. Just watch his eyes. I bet you've never done this before. And watch how his eyes are darting all over that room as if he's looking for a shooter. You know what I'm talking about, don't you, Dyson?
Doc, you, again, your research is so thick and so beautiful and so insightful. As we know, Dr. King didn't feel comfortable unless he was in a room without windows. Mm-hmm. Why? Because to your point, he was always imagining who might shoot him, what bullet might crease the pain and find its resting place inside of his body. And so he had horrible hiccups. He had horrible fear. He looked all around the room, and that's a brilliant point you're making. It was not simply his oratorical skill and ability to look around and involve everybody in the room. He's on the lookout as a one-man search for the potential murderer that was inevitably coming to him. And we heard it in his speech. He literally is announcing it. Some have said about one of our sick white brothers. You know, that goes on right before the part you played. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. And so he knows about the sick white brothers and the report that they are out there to kill him. And let's be real. He could have had given that speech for the last 4 or 5 years of his life because they were threatening him every day. And these were credible threats, not some people who got mad and said some stuff. These are credible threats. And how do we know? Because the FBI withheld from Dr. King knowledge of credible threats to his life. So not only was he being pursued and hounded by white supremacist actors who, on behalf of a bigoted nation, would snuff out the greatest living black man and therefore the greatest living American, but they were also aided and abetted by a government that had turned its hide against Dr. King. Yeah. So this is the pressure under which he lived, and you're right. Very few people realize that Dr. King lived with that fear, which makes that speech even greater.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
It's deep enough. And look, you and I have both had death threats. Now, when I first started getting them, I was like, man, how am I going to talk?
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to speak with some idiot who might come out here and hurt me? This man is throwing down with the greatest ease of oratorical expression.
I can only tell you this. Well, matter of fact, let me just tell you this story when we come forward. To Dyson's point, he and I both received death threats in the course of our career. One night I was on book tour in Philadelphia, and the FBI, I was on PBS then, the FBI contacted PBS to let them know that there were credible threats against my life and that it might go down that evening in Philadelphia. PBS got the word to me I had a decision to make about whether to step to the podium in Philadelphia that night. When we come forward, I'll tell you what happened. We're talking with Michael Eric Dyson on Tavis Smiley.
Unapologetically progressive. Progressive. Unapologetically black. 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 You're tapped into Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
It works.
Let's get back to more of Tavis Smiley right now.
More of Michael Eric Dyson right now on Tavis Smiley. We're honored to have him on today and in this hour as we commemorate the anniversary 56 years ago today of the death, the murder, frankly, of MLK. I caught myself on that word. It wasn't just death, it was murder. There's been great debate, Michael Eric Dyson, as you know, over the years, when people use that phrase, and they're well-intentioned, when they say Dr. King gave his life for us, he gave his life for us. Well, Jesus did give his life for us, but right. I'm not so sure that we're accurate, even though we're well-intentioned, when we say that Dr. King gave his life for us, or is that much ado about nothing, sir?
Well, look, I understand your point there, but look, Jesus was like, if this cup can pass, can somebody else drink it?
Yes.
Because I ain't really trying to really do that.
That's true.
So Jesus was at the time like, you know, yeah, I knew it was a good idea while I was up in heaven. But down here on earth, and I didn't live to 33 years, it's rough. So the point is, Dr. King had his moment too. Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. That's Gethsemane.
Yeah.
But longevity has its place. That's accepting I got to go to Golgotha. And he made a deliberate choice, Dr. King did, by saying any man who hasn't found something he's willing to die for isn't fit to live.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, no, he didn't want to die. Yes, he wanted to live a long life, but he knew by participating in the grand and great struggle for freedom and to make democracy real in this country that inevitably he would lose his life. He was sitting with his wife, and she recalls this in her autobiography, after John F. Kennedy was murdered, and they're looking at the proceedings on television, King turns to her and says, the same thing will happen to me. And Coretta Scott King says, I couldn't tell him no.
Mm.
Can you imagine? Mm. You're looking for solace, and your very wife knows that what you're saying about the almost inevitability of your surrender of life will occur. So in that sense, Tavis, I think that Dr. King made a conscious decision to give his life to the movement, which potentially meant that he would have to give his life up in order to realize its goals and ambitions.
Fair enough. Dr. Dyson knows what he speaks because he's written extensively about Dr. King, but one of my favorite books of his, and he's got more books than I can count. He got more books than Mary J. got videos. One of my favorite books from Dr. Dyson is I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr. One of my favorite books, again, from Dyson, I May Not Get There With You. If you never read it, I highly recommend you get your hands on it. I said before the break, I'd tell you the story about Philadelphia, only because I want to be simpatico with Dyson about what it means to navigate every day when your life is under threat. I'm in Philadelphia one night on tour, about to make an appearance at the library there. I love the library there in Philadelphia, right in downtown. Beautiful space, been there many times. But on this night, the FBI contacts PBS, PBS contacts me and tells me there's a credible threat against me, and they're concerned about me taking the stage that night in Philadelphia. Long story short, I got on my knees where I was, and I prayed, and I asked the Lord to get me through that evening. I didn't want to disappoint the people who were there, nor did I want to tell people I was canceling because of death threats. So I prayed, got up off my knees, went in, and did my thing. But I will tell you, Michael Eric Dyson, on that night, good brother, my respect for MLK went through the roof. I didn't think I could respect him anymore because standing there trying to deliver a speech when you got a credible FBI threat about somebody trying to take your life, it's a difficult thing to do. And so to your point, the speech that King gave that night is all the more brilliant because he was under that threat day in and day out, and he handled his business that night nonetheless.
I mean, that was amazing, and I got the call later on, the message, I got it too late, where you invited me to take your place, but I
made
that call.
So. much to my chagrin, you didn't answer the call that night.
Well, Travis, you were always offering me a better chance. Boy, I'm going to lift you up. But anyway, that kind of courage is unimaginable to somebody who hasn't had to do it. And you have had to do it more than once. You're being humble. You've had to do it more than once. I've had to do it more than once. And it is more than an ocean to stand there to deliver speech. And imagine King being under the threat of death every day, no matter where he went, that the possibility of his death. So his conquering of death didn't mean that he wasn't still worried, doesn't mean that he was inviting death in a cavalier fashion. It meant that he had solved the ultimate riddle, that my life will have meaning whether I'm here on earth or whether I've gone to my reward. And he couldn't have imagined, even in his great mind, of what the impact his death would have on America. And that's in great measure a tribute to his wife, Coretta Scott King, who carried that baton at the death of Martin Luther King Jr. And it's because of her efforts, along with John Conyers and Stevie Wonder, John Conyers, the late great congressman who put the bill forth for Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, and Stevie Wonder, who released that great song. But it was the effort of Coretta Scott King, because as you've written brilliantly, and I've talked about, King was at the low point of his popularity when he died.
That's right.
He would have never had organically a holiday. She had to put in the work to remind America about the meaning of this man, and it's because of her work that Martin Luther King Jr. today is celebrated in the culture the way he is.
Let me wrap this conversation about Dr. King before we move on to other issues with Dr. Dyson between now and the top of the hour. Let me wrap with this. I'd be remiss talking about King's assassination on this day, 56 years ago, April 4. I'd be remiss to not mention the name of one Maya Angelou. Because April 4 was the day they killed Martin, but it's also the day that Maya Angelou was born. April 4th was her birthday. And many of you know that Maya was like a surrogate mother to me. When she passed, I wrote a book called My Journey with Maya. She first took me out of this country. My very first trip out of this country was to Africa, carrying Maya's bags for 10 days in Africa. And all kinds of great stories I could share if I had the time about my journey with her over the 26 years of our friendship, it seems. April 4 was her birthday, and she told me many, many stories about her friendship with Dr. King, and many, many stories about her being in the kitchen that day in her brownstone in New York and Harlem when news came, and she was putting the finishing touches on a dinner she was serving with her friends that night, serving to her friends that night at her home. News came while she's finishing up dinner that Dr. King had been killed, and it just ruined her day. And every April 4 thereafter, she spent some time with Coretta Scott King. She and Coretta Scott King would talk on the phone or be in person every single year thereafter on April 4th. So as we commemorate the assassination of Dr. King, we celebrate the birthday of one Maya Angelou. So when we come forward, I'm going to show you how brilliant Dyson really is. There ain't a Negro in this country I could ask this question of other than Michael Eric Dyson. So I'm going to ask Dyson to segue me from MLK to Beyonce. I don't know what this Negro is going to do, but I know Dyson can do it. How do I get from MLK to Beyonce? Watch how he does this when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
This is getting good.
Yeah, man.
Tavis Smiley, continues when we come forward. He's rooting for everybody black. More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now.
All right, Michael Eric Dyson, segue me from MLK to Beyonce.
You can imagine two Southern children, one born in Atlanta, the other born in Houston. Both prodigies. At a young age, Martin Luther King Jr. Was set up on a soapbox so that he could sing at the tender age of 3, 4, and 5. Beyonce was engaging in talent contests at an age barely older than that. And then you think about both of them being reared with Southern accents in a culture that was skeptical about black humanity and black intellectual ability. And then beyond that, both of them using their platforms to change the world. Martin Luther King Jr. as a spokesman for civil rights, and Beyonce as arguably the greatest entertainer that this world has ever seen. And beyond that, on April 4th, 2008, 40 years after Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, Jay-Z and Beyonce tied the knot on this day. So this is the 16th wedding anniversary of the first couple of black entertainment, and therefore they have a link, both literally on this day, when one left, the other embraced a new life together, but both of them outstanding geniuses who have allowed the black voice to reverberate around the world and bring us into higher consciousness about our purpose here on earth.
That's why you can't fade the M to the E to the D. I didn't know what was coming, but I knew it was going to be rich, and I knew nobody could do it quite the way Dr. Dyson does it, there's the proof. So that said, I don't need to color this question much more. There's all kinds of commentary about it, but I'm interested now in your commentary about Cowboy Carter.
I mean, is the girl doing her thing? Is the woman so deep and cold? I'm category-less. That's what she might as well be saying. It's a country album, to be sure. The twang, the steel guitar, the banjo playing, and, of course, the harmonica of none other than Stevie Wonder. The remakes of Jolene, but with a growl. Jolene was being begged not to take Dolly Parton's man, but Beyonce is threatening Jolene that she better not try to take her man. But beyond that, it's not just country music, it's this country's music. Mm. And Beyonce is ranging out even beyond country. She's giving country a new kind of ethos. Because it's not merely what we hear in Patsy Cline or Hank Williams or Garth Brooks. It is a country that is imbued with the blues, with the sensitivity of rhythm and blues, with soul, with gospel. And also, she's doing some rock, she's doing some funk, she's doing a little bit of jazz stuff. I mean, she is remarkable in her ability to stretch the genre to show that from the very beginning, black folk have been involved in what we now call country and Western. They shorten it to country, but also her bona fides are real. She's in Houston. She's a Southern girl. Cowboy boots and hats are not foreign to her. And you know that old saying, he was all cowboy hat and no cattle.
Mm-hmm.
All hat and no cattle. She got hat, cattle, and horses and everything else besides that. And she's brilliantly, she's really reshaping country, even as she has absorbed within it, even as they were skeptical, some of them, about what she could do with it. Not only is she at the top of the charts, she's charted a new path for people who are doing country and giving light to those people like Linda Martell, who have been doing country from the get-go, who never got their due, and the backup singers, including Miss Adele and others, who she has really, really given the light to. This is the genius of Beyonce, and the album is utterly remarkable, and I recommend anybody who hasn't listened to it to definitely give it a listen.
So that's what's on the album, at least to the ears of Michael Eric Dyson. When we come forward in our remaining moments, I want to talk about the album cover. Again, that's what's on the project, but that cover has also generated a great deal of conversation and some controversy. We'll talk about that part with Michael Eric Dyson in our remaining moments when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward. More honesty than you can handle.
More empowerment than you can imagine.
You're tuned in to Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
Michael Eric Dyson, you and I know, believe in never putting the flag above the cross for myriad reasons, not the least of which is because that red, white, and blue is complicated, and yet Beyonce sort of wraps herself in that on the cover of this album, which has caused a great deal of conversation and some consternation. Your commentary, sir.
Well, look, it's a brilliant move. Think about her husband and Kanye on Watch the Throne, where they're speaking about America. And they're talking about This is America, or think about Childish Gambino. There's a long history of black people laying claim to historic legacies from which they have been excluded. Ray Charles singing about America the Beautiful, and Al Sharpton said he's singing about something he ain't ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
So you know he got hope and faith. So here's the point. Beyonce is reclaiming that American flag for all black people who have been said not to be American. After all, she says this album in part was inspired by going to the CMA, the Country Music Association, and singing with then the Dixie Chicks, as they were then known, and somebody hollered, "Get that black bee off stage." And so she is reclaiming our rightful ownership, if you will, of that flag as much as anybody else. The red part is seen, the blood we've shed, but the blue part, representing justice, is somehow hidden. It has not yet been revealed. She is naked beneath all of that. Why? Because she's vulnerable as a black figure, as a black artist, as a black agent of our destiny. And she's standing there saying, I'm going to represent this flag because it represents Texas's black cowboys and the rodeo culture that people don't know anything about. The flag is a sign of American empire, of imperialism and dominance and hegemony all over the world. She's reclaiming it for the purposes of justice, of freedom and democracy. And I think what she's doing, she's never given credit for this kind of complexity because she's a black woman, and black female genius is rarely recognized to the degree and to the extent that it represents all of us as black people. And I think what Beyonce has done is extremely valuable, provocative, and so purposeful and substantive.
I've got 60 seconds left. I'll give it to you. There is great conversation again about whether or not she is or will be embraced by the country music industry. My exit question is, does it matter?
It don't matter, because she said, this ain't no country album. This a Beyonce album. B, I'm bigger than all of y'all. I represent what I represent. I'm blessing you. You ain't blessing me. But guess what? She breaking all kind of records at the same time. So she's having her cake, and she's eating off of it as well. Go ahead, B. Do your thing. You've got the whole country wearing your chain, and we appreciate that kind of celebration.
Ain't nobody like him. Michael Eric Dyson. Honored to have him on this program today and anytime if I can get him, for that matter. And so we close again saying how grateful we are for the life and legacy of one Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated 56 years ago today. In Memphis, Tennessee. We close this program by thanking God for the work and witness of one Maya Angelou, who was born on this day, April 4. And as Dr. Dyson brilliantly reminded us, we also say congratulations to Beyonce and Jay-Z, who were married on April 4, 16 years ago. A lot to talk about, a lot to celebrate, a lot to be thankful for on this day, April 4, 2024. And I'm thankful, as always, for you, Michael Eric Dyson. Love you, man. Ain't nothing you can do about it. Love you like a fat kid loves cake.
Love you too, brother. Love you like a brother avoiding Philadelphia when the death threats are on.
More time to Smiley when we come forward.